About a month ago, one of us came up to me and pulled a little piece of paper out of his pocket, and he said, "What is this?" And I said, "A piece of paper." And he said, "No, read what's on it." And he had written on it, E-R-U-V. And I said, it's Eruv. And he said, "Well, what is it?" I said, "Well, why are you asking me?" He said, "Well, I read an article in the paper that the Orthodox community is demanding some kind of crazy thing, and I want to know what it's all about." Therefore, this talk on the Talmud and the telephone poles. If I were to take you to my library, where I have a translation of the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, you discover that this word, E-R-U-V, Eruv, is the title of one of the thickest, fattest volumes in the Talmud. One of the 63 legal sections in the Mishnah deals with Eruv. It was obviously a very old tradition in Jewish life, and it's obviously a very complex and complicated one, because the rabbis of the Talmudic period, both in Palestine and in Babylon, dealt with it at length and produced two massive volumes dealing with its practice, its forms, its meaning. And I guess what we can really say is that there's no better measure of the distance that Jewish life has come than the sense that I suspect no one here really knew what an Eruv was until a few strange people in the Orthodox community began to demand that they have one. And when I try to understand how best to present this matter to you, I thought I'd begin by asking you to play a Jewish Sherlock Holmes. I'm going to read to you a very brief paragraph. It was written by a man named Abd al-Suri Sal ibn Masliach. As you can tell from the name, being Sherlock Holmes's, this man lived in the Arab world. His name Abd al-Suri means that he came from a family which originated in what was the Oxford or Cambridge of Babylonian Jewry, Sura, probably from a learned Jewish family. Actually, he lived 1,000 years ago, about 960, 980 of this era in Jerusalem. We know very little about him except that he wrote a number of biblical commentaries and a Sefer HaMitzvot, a book of that dealt with the commandments of the Torah. And he also published a letter to a rabbi in Cairo, and this is the paragraph I want to read to you. And I want you to tell me who he is complaining about. Salam ben Masliach writes, "How can I restrain myself when many Jews leave their houses on the Sabbath on their way to their synagogue, carrying various things such as purses and pieces of apparel upon their arms, while their wives wear jewelry? And as they do on weekdays, visit from house to house, so do they also on the Sabbath." Now, if you guess that he is complaining about the lax orthodoxy of a rabbinic Jewish community, you'd be wrong. There is nothing in rabbinic law which precludes visitations from home to home on the Sabbath. There is nothing in rabbinic law which, under many conditions, would prohibit the wearing of jewelry or the carrying of small objects, a handkerchief, an eyeglass case, a talit bag, on the Sabbath. Actually, this man was writing to a rabbi in Cairo, complaining that this man was misleading his flock by permitting these kinds of activities. For Sal ben Masliach came of that group which we know as the Karaites. The Karaites were schismatic Jews, which means simply that the majority of Jews did not follow their understanding of the tradition, who believed that the rabbis and sages of the Talmud had deliberately misinterpreted biblical Judaism to their people, and that one must follow the Bible, the Torah, exactly, and not according to rabbinic interpretation. The Karaites developed in the Middle East about the same time as Islam spread across the Middle East. If we remember what Protestantism means basically, that is, the right to interpret the Bible directly rather than through the eyes of the church, we can call the Karaites early Jewish Protestants, for they insisted on the right of interpreting the Torah directly themselves, not through the overlay of interpretation which Rabbinic Judaism had placed upon it. They were eager to do this because they were impatient. They were the early Zionists, if you will. They wanted to hasten the coming of the Messiah, to hasten the end of the exile. They felt that they accepted the idea, which was common throughout Judaism, that we suffered in exile, we, the Jewish people of their day, because we had transgressed against the law of God. The temple had been destroyed because the people of their time had sinned against the covenant. And the exile remained in being because Israel remained a sinning nation. But the Karaites believed that Israel really was a rather observant nation, really a nation of rather pious and good people. And that the reason that the exile lingered on was not because of the people, but because of the rabbis. Because the rabbis had misinterpreted the tradition and allowed the people to do that which was forbidden, and forbidden the people to do that which is allowed, and therefore the people were violating the covenant without deliberately meaning to do so. And they called Israel back to the true faith, as they understood it, a literal, or rather literal, understanding of the Torah. As an example, in the Sabbath laws in the Torah, there is the rule, Lo tevaru esh b'kol moshvotechem b'yom ha-shabbat. You shall not burn a fire in any of your dwelling places on the Sabbath day. Now the rabbis, not wanting to make the Sabbath too rigorous or too rigid, had interpreted the phrase, you shall not burn a fire, as you shall not kindle a fire. And we all know that fires were begun before the Sabbath day in the stove and then just allowed to burn throughout the day. In modern times, a light is lit in the house and simply it's allowed to remain lighted throughout the 24 hours of the Sabbath period. But that's not literally what the Torah says. The verb ba'ar means to burn. And the literal meaning is you shall not allow a fire to burn during the Sabbath day. And the Karaites, at least during the first two, three, four centuries of their being, in their homes, extinguished all lights, extinguished all fires. The Sabbath day must have been a very cold and dismal occasion for them. But they was compensated for by the fact that they felt they were hastening the end of the exile and the coming of the Messiah. Now, what has all this to do with Saul's complaint or the Eruv? In the 16th chapter of Exodus, the Torah explains how it was that the Jews provisioned for themselves during the long period, the 40 years of the wilderness wandering. Obviously, no group can prepare for 40 years of wandering, particularly a group of slaves who have nothing, who left Egypt in haste. And so the Bible says that, in fact, God made all the provisions for them. He provided the water out of the rock. He provided quail for meat, and he provided the famous manna as the basic food of the people. And the manna, the Bible said, descended each day, each morning like the dew, and was like a white hoarfrost on the ground, much as it must have looked, if you follow the images of the Bible, much as we see, unfortunately, out the window. And each day the Hebrews would go out and pick up enough manna for that day, and the sun would burn away the rest, and the next day another provisioning would take place. But what about the Sabbath? Going out collecting food is a form of work. And so on the Sabbath day, according to the Torah, there was another miracle. That is, on Friday, a double portion of the manna fell, enough to carry over for the Sabbath. And this is the way that miracle is explained and interpreted in the 16th chapter of Exodus. Mark that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he has given you two days' food on the sixth day. Let everyone remain where he is. Let no man leave his place on the seventh day. Lo yetzei ish mimakomo b'yom hashvi'i. that no man leave his place, his home, on the seventh day. And the Karaites took this literally. We were not only to stay in a cold, unlit home, but you were to stay at home during the Sabbath day, except, of course, to go make the brief journey to the Karaite synagogue to engage there in prayers. But otherwise, no visiting, no carrying, no moving about. Now, obviously, that's not the traditional way, if by tradition we mean rabbinic Judaism. And the Eruv was the way in which the symbolic act through which the rabbis enlarged the sense of place to allow Jews to move about a good bit on the Sabbath. Now, the rabbis could not eliminate a specific requirement of the Torah. The Torah says you are not to leave your place on the seventh day. But what they could do was to reinterpret place, your place, to include something much larger than the small room or rooms in which your family lived. So with the casuistic skills of a lawyer or Jesuit, whatever stereotype you have of a person who has casuistic skills, what they did was to say, what defines one's home? What defines a place? First is that it is a place in which we provision and we eat, which we keep food and eat food. The second, it is a place for which we have a certain title. We have a certain piece of paper or claim that it can be substantiated in the courts. And finally, it is a definable place. It has boundaries. And what they did was to extend this sense of place to include parts of the larger community. How did they do this? The word Eruv means combination or mixture. It comes from the same root as the phrase mixed multitude, Erev Rav, by which the Torah describes the group that came out with Moses from Egypt. In addition to the Israelites, there was an Erev Rav, a combination of other peoples, a mixed multitude. And when the rabbis wanted to use the same phrase that the United Jewish Appeal used several years ago to speak of the unity of the Jewish people, we are one, they said, Kol Yisrael Arev Zeh Bazeh. All Israel is mixed together, is part of a single combination, part of a single family, if you will. And the Eruv was a way in which you mixed together, you enlarged that which belonged to many so that each person, in a sense, had a claim in it, and it became, by extension, symbolically, his home, his place in which he could move about. Now, in ancient Judea, most cities were small, and most cities were walled. And what the sages apparently did, probably in Second Temple times, was to declare the wall of the city, and these are small towns, the wall of the city, the enclosure, which defined the home, and they would buy with monies given from all members of the home some food which they would place in a central location, a synagogue, where all could technically enter and partake of the food. This established that element of home. And then they drew up some kind of document which established the rights of the individual and of each household in this home, for at least for purposes of the Eruv. And now home defined all the area that was within the circumference of the walls. And it freed the Jews of that time, to that town, to move about within those walls rather freely on the Sabbath day. And to carry within that town whatever they were allowed to carry within their own homes. An infant, a doctor carrying his bag to go out on a case where there wasn't a provable threat of death to the patient, the bag of the talit, the prayer shawl, eyeglasses, a cane, whatever you will. Now, we don't know how this custom originated. According to the Talmud, it is ascribed to one of the ordinances of King Solomon. And of this one thing I'm sure King Solomon did not ordain the Eruv. King Solomon, however, was the great figure of wisdom to our people in ancient times, and his wisdom was God-given. You remember the story in the Bible that when he is crowned, God says, choose what you wish, make any wish that you want. And the wish that Solomon asked is for a wise heart, an understanding heart. And so his wisdom comes from God, and what he promulgated, what he pronounced as law, has the same force in rabbinic law as other rules which are actually inscribed in the Bible itself. Incidentally, they ascribe to him the law which says that all Jews must wash their hands before touching food. So he wasn't so dumb after all. Sometime during the biblical period, probably during or after the exile, when the Sabbath laws became more onerous, the rabbis or the sages, whoever was in charge of the tradition at the time, were faced with a problem. The original Sabbath was simply a day of rest. By rest, the biblical man meant not working, not farming, not doing business, not engaging in commerce. And if you read the complaints of the prophets about those who violate the Sabbath, these complaints have to do entirely with these kinds of gross activities on the Sabbath, not with the punctilia, the minutiae of Sabbath observance. This is from a prophet, an anonymous prophet, whose material appears at the end of the scroll of Isaiah. If you refrain from trampling the Sabbath, from pursuing your business affairs in my holy day, if you call the Sabbath my delight, the Lord's day honored, if you honor it and go not your ways, nor look to your affairs, nor strike bargains, then you can seek the favor of the Lord. Originally, then, the Sabbath was simply a day in which one avoided work and in which some kinds of very special rites took place in the temple. But when the Jews went into the East and during the Babylonian exile, they were deeply influenced by people to whom the punctilia of ritual made a great deal of difference. The Zoroastrian tradition, the Hindu tradition, the Persian tradition generally is one which is very concerned with clean and unclean, with all levels of purity, with all the proper form in which various religious rites are carried out. Jews brought back from the exile most of the laws which have to do with kashrut, most of the rules which have to do with bathing after touching a corpse and contaminations of those kinds. And probably the attempt to make the Sabbath into something more rigorous and rigid developed during this time. But there's also true that you can't impose upon a community rules which a community will not accept. And clearly the community was not willing to accept a literal interpretation of this oracular text, which is in the book of Exodus, that everybody had to stay home and live in a cold house during the 24-hour period of the Sabbath. And so you got the development of a symbolic act, a ritual, which will allow the Sabbath to be something more than it had been up to this point, but which freed it from many of the most rigorous denials which the law specifically required. And so you have this rather strange rite, which demands that there be an enclosure, a certificate of title for purposes of the Eruv, and food at some central location. And in most communities that have been where there have been Jews over any period of time in history, there have in fact been in existence an Eruv of one kind or another. Because if you read the response of the rabbis through the centuries, you recognize that most traditional Jews were not willing to accept even the rigors of their own rabbinic tradition unless they had the kind of amplitude which an Eruv would provide them. And so the rabbis say again and again, let's find a way in this town or that town to establish an Eruv so that the people will not be guilty of sinning. And they almost assume that they will sin, that they will do what they should not do, but would do legally if an Eruv were permitted. And so if we look in Europe, most European towns had these boundaries, these Eruvim, Frankfurt, Vienna, Warsaw. It was rather easy in the towns where there were ghettos. The ghetto walls became the enclosure. Everything that was owned within the walls was owned by Jews, so it was easy to get the title that was required. And the problem arose, however, on two levels. Problems arose on two levels. The first had to do with people who lived in towns where there were no walls, in detached dwellings of one kind or another. And the second had to do with people who lived among unfriendly neighbors who might not be willing to give them the title which they required. In the first case, what the rabbis already in the Talmudic age established was that one could create a symbolic enclosure, and that's where the telephone poles come in. What the Talmud says is this: if one sets up an area which is to be the area of the Eruv and puts in the ground poles at least 10 handbreadths high and connects them at the top with a cord, this creates a symbolic sense of boundary. And it has what the rabbis called surat ha-petach, the form of a gate. And this allows the limits to be established within which my home, my place, can be defined. And obviously in modern times, or Mr. Bell never thought of this when the telephone system began to be put in, they are built-in poles connected at the top. They're wonderfully useful for this kind of purpose. Now, what about getting the document that's required? In Europe, by and large, a few dollars were exchanged and the document was granted. And it was only a question of how much the traffic would bear. In the United States, it's a matter of finding the legal way to give the community a right to that area for purposes only of the Eruv. It's a right which can be given without other legal encumbrances. It can be done. There are Eruvim in a number of American cities, in Baltimore, in Rigo Park, and in Queens, in the Bronx. There's one in Toronto. So it can be done without any complicated conflict of church and state and without the municipalities involved giving over any substantial rights which ought not to be given to any religious group. What does it all mean? Well, it means in the first place that we're seeing the Americanization of parts of the Orthodox Jewish community. And by that I mean that they're simply no longer hunkering down in their areas, doing their own thing, but they are demanding, as Jews and other minority groups have always demanded, certain rights which will allow them to live life with a little more amplitude than they might otherwise be able to do. Instead of being passive, they're being more aggressive. And that's a truly form of Americanization. It means also that those who lead this community, this Orthodox Jewish community, are having more say in its organization. There's a phrase in American Jewish sociology, the non-observant Orthodox. And though the Orthodox community itself is small, about 8% of the Jewish community of Cleveland, those who obey the rigors of the tradition are a smaller minority yet. But they have increasingly had their say within the councils of Orthodoxy, and they're increasingly insisting that things be done rigorously, things be done zealously, with real concern for the fullness of the ancient traditions. Should we agree to it? Why not? If creating an Eruv will allow a few in our community to live with a greater sense of ease, particularly women, because one of the real pressures for the Eruv came from a few rabbis' wives and others who felt restricted in terms of being able to carry an infant to the synagogue or something of that kind on the Sabbath day, which without this they would felt constrained not to do. It says something, however, I think also to us. It says how far we have come from the ancient ways, that something which was as important and as common as the Eruv had become something of which we were not even dimly aware, and that the call to return to tradition, which some of us feel has begun to permeate all non-Orthodox traditions, is one which has limits to it. I can't imagine anyone in the Reform or conservative communities of Cleveland really caring for themselves whether an Eruv is in existence or not. So what we mean when we speak of a return to tradition is not a return to the whole complex system of halakha, which existed before, but rather that we need certain forms, whatever they be, which define for us what it means to live a Jewish life, which reinforce us in our sense of Jewishness. Now, the difference between orthodoxy and non-orthodoxy has to do with the acceptance of the divinity of the halakha. To the Orthodox, it is all one law, God-given. To the non-Orthodox, it is tradition, it is rich, it is often suggestive, full of insight and wise, but it is, in a sense, manufactured, artificial, in the finest sense of the word, a creation of human art. And we feel every right to pick, to choose, to be eclectic. We retain much because a sense of continuity is important to us. We reject a great deal because it would be spiritually insignificant to us. I can't imagine the Eruv being significant to any one of us here today. To an Orthodox congregation, it might, in fact, symbolize the sense of community. To us, I suspect it symbolizes only the confusions which exist because of distance, because of space, because of suburbia. And many of us, for instance, I'm one of them, wish those telephone poles did not exist. I've long since been unhappy with the utility because it refuses to spend the money to bury the cables in the ground. Fewer posts rather than more, fewer dangerous wires up there to be touched. But think how much more difficult then creating an Eruv would in fact be. So what I'm suggesting to you is that one of the great and continuing debates in Jewish life has been the debate over the degree of observance and the kind of observance which Jews are obliged to engage in. And an interesting reversal has taken place. And with this I close. The Karaites claimed, David ben Masliach was claiming that the Orthodox were too reform. That's essentially what he was saying. That they were permitting what the Torah prohibits. The Orthodox today are complaining that we have gone too far in permitting what they prohibit. And what is it? It is simply that we deal with different groups of people, different degrees of acculturation, different emotional and psychological needs. The Orthodox of the Middle Ages, the Orthodox of the Talmudic time, had to find a way to mitigate the rigors of the Sabbath as was being developed in the late biblical age. The Eruv was their way of doing it. We found it necessary in the 19th and 20th century to mitigate the degree of constriction which many felt imposed upon them by the fullness and the complexity of rabbinic law. And so we created a non-Orthodox Judaism. Can we go too far in that? Can we throw out the baby with the wash? Obviously we can, and obviously some did. But shall we, because of that, find it necessary to go back to the fullness of the tradition? But we reject the very basis on which the tradition substantiates, sanctifies itself, and more than that, it's simply not congruent with the way that we live. And so we essentially have to find in the non-Orthodox tradition the basis from which allows us to justify, to express, and to be satisfied with our sancta, our way. And by and large, what we do is to pull from the tradition and sanctify it by the sense of meaning. Does it speak to us? Does it encourage us? Does it give us a sense of the sacred? If it does, we accept it. Does it simply restrict us, constrict us, fill our lives with a series of minutiae which have no meaning any longer to us? If so, we reject it. And that's really the way in which non-orthodoxy has developed, and that's the great difference between those to whom the telephone poles are important and those of us who would like the telephone poles to be go the way of all flesh and the lines to be buried deep in the earth. Amen.